We had got to the point at the end of the last lecture where the Schaeffers had just been notified that they were thrown out of Switzerland. That notification came on February the 14th, and they were told that they would have to be out of the canton of Valais by March the 31st, and out of Switzerland by March the 31st, in 6 weeks' time. Of course, they were tremendously crushed when they got this news. They thought that God was leading them to start a new work, or rather continue a work, in which people from every nation would come to their home in the mountains and learn God's truth and come to know Him and walk in His ways. They were sure that they had been praying for a life of reality, for the demonstration of God's existence. And their response when they got this news was this, and these are quoting Edith's words: "How could this staggering blow be in line with the life of reality we've been praying for? How could this staggering blow be in line with the life of reality we've been praying for?" It's a very good question, and I think, in fact, as we go through what then happened, this staggering blow was actually, in a way, the best possible way, the most dramatic way in which they were going to be given the reality that they had been praying for. And that's what I want us to look at today, how they were given that reality that they were praying for, that they would be able to see what God can do in a seemingly humanly impossible situation. I think, in a way, it's rather like Gideon. The situation he was put in, you remember, where he had to fight the forces of Midian, and God kept cutting down his resources till he just had 300 men left, or however many it was, and no weapons, basically, and except those pitchers and their lights hidden underneath them, and how God used that to overthrow the armies of Midian. And this staggering blow really put them in the situation of seeing that they had no resources, really, to do the work that God was calling them to do, but they would have to stand like Gideon and see what God was going to do. Now, as I said at the end last time, they voted as a family, including Frankie, who was then two, that they would, rather than trying to contact everybody they knew to do something about their situation, writing back to the States and getting people to contact senators and congressmen and so on, that they would pray that God would solve their problems for them. And they carried on with their work. Right after they got the letter, if you read the account of this staggering blow in the tapestry, they carried on serving tea to a group of boys who were coming to their house for a discussion. Who stayed till very late that night, and Edith comments on how in that situation Fran was able to put aside his anxieties and to really pray that God would help him give answers. And she says that night there seemed to be a special power of the Holy Spirit on him as he answered those boys' questions. Now, how did God begin to answer their prayers? And I want to suggest a series of ways in which he did. The first was immediately after they prayed that God would in fact solve this problem for them, together as a family, each of them praying one by one. Francis said, "Well, it's come to my mind that we want to contact one of our Swiss friends and let him know what's happening." One of our Swiss Protestant friends. And they contacted Monsieur André, the lawyer. In fact, it was very important that they did, because he was able to discover by reading the letter carefully, because of course his French was very much better than theirs, that the letter they had received was predated, and that they only had 36 hours left to appeal against the command to leave the country. There were just 36 hours left, and if they had not gone to see him, they wouldn't have known that, and if their appeal would have probably been handed late. So they went to see Monsieur André. His response was something like, "This can't happen in Switzerland. This is a country with freedom of religion. This is impossible." They then felt they ought to go to see the American consul. They went to the consulate in Geneva. And this is the second way that God answered their prayers. He comforted them with his word as they were traveling along on the train. And Edith writes about the passage that she read from the book of Isaiah. It's on page 412 in the tapestry. That's right, Isaiah 30, verses 17 and 20 and 21. And God used these words to comfort her tremendously. Isaiah 30:17, a thousand will flee at the threat of one. At the threat of five, you will all flee away till you are left like a flagstaff on a mountaintop, like a banner on a hill. And these words were a great encouragement to her that God, in fact, was going to give them their home on the mountains, despite their seemingly impossible situation. And then the next verse is verse 20 and 21. Although the Lord gives you the bread of adversity and the water of affliction, your teachers will be hidden no more. With your own eyes you will see them. Whether you turn to the right or to the left, your ears will hear a voice behind you saying, "This is the way, walk in it." A wonderful promise from God that even though difficulties would come their way, yet he was going to show them the way and enable them to walk in it. So that was the second way in which God comforted them. As they were traveling on the train to Geneva, these words from the book of Isaiah were a tremendous comfort, and they shared their readings with each other. The third answer to their prayers, as they began to see God unfolding things for them, was that when they got to the consulate in Geneva, they discovered that the consul was a high school friend of Schaefer's from Germantown High School in Pennsylvania, that they hadn't seen each other for all those years, but they had been in the same class, even in the same high school in Germantown, many years before. And he said he would do whatever he could to try to be some kind of help to them. And that seemed to them a wonderful answer to their prayers too, that right at that situation, at that time, there was this man there who had a personal interest in them going back all those years. The fourth thing was the discovery of what they needed in order to be able to stay. This isn't so much an answer to prayer, but setting out rather what they had to pray for. Just how huge the mountain was that had to be climbed to find an answer to their situation. First of all, they needed to find a house which they had to rent or buy. It had to be in a village in a different canton. They had been living in Champéry, which I've drawn for you there on the board. On the one side of the mountains, you've got the Rhone Valley running down from Switzerland down towards Italy as the valley goes down. The canton of Valais, which was a Roman Catholic canton where they had been living in Champéry, is on the right-hand side there. They had to find another house in another canton, first of all, to rent or to buy. Secondly, they would have to come up with village approval for them to live there. The village would have to agree that they would be happy to have them live in that village. They would have to have a financial arrangement to rent or buy the house completed by the time the application was sent in. Fourthly, the local commune, it's the commune of Olon in that area, which is a little town just up the side of the mountain from the valley at the bottom where the little city of Aigle is. But in the commune of Olon, the commune of Olon would have to agree that they could stay there and then apply to the canton for them to actually live in that commune. And then fifthly, the federal government would have to agree that it was all right for them to stay and would have to annul the verdict which had been given against them, that they had to leave Valais and they had to leave the country because of the religious influence they had had in the village of Champéry. So they had a huge mountain to climb, we may say, metaphorically, in terms of the things that had to be done in the short amount of time they'd got. So that was what they needed, what they had to pray for. Their friends were able to help them to see all these points that had to be got through in the time they'd got. So they started looking desperately for a house. Houses in Switzerland are incredibly expensive. They were even then. The real estate agent they went to only had houses which were deluxe houses and said he had nothing whatsoever to offer the kind of budget that they had to deal with, which, you remember, was already shortened because they had just heard not long before from the Independent Mission Board that their salary was going to be cut. Well, had been in fact lowered, so they hadn't got very much to go on. So they started looking around and weren't able to find anything at all for rent that was in their means whatsoever. They were left with only 2 days to go. And Edith recounts what happened at this stage. They were looking around, getting increasingly discouraged. And they were up in the village of Chezières, which is between Weymouth and Villars on that map. I should have drawn that for you as well. But Chezières is a little village just adjoining Villars, just slightly below Villars on the mountain. Chezières. They're in the village of Chezières looking around for houses, and when suddenly somebody called them across the street. And it was Professor and Madame Czerny, Czerny, the couple from Czechoslovakia who were working there in Switzerland, who had become Christians through their work, saying, "We need help." And Edith's response is, "Well, we're the ones who need help, not you." But I think God taught them both at this time a tremendously important lesson. They were just overwhelmed with their own situation. What he gave them was something to do. Again, just a reminder from him that if there was going to be some provision for them, he was the one who was going to give it. But right now, they had something to do. The Czernys were in a desperate situation. She was 7 months pregnant and had been feeling very ill, and they just wanted help. They went over to start talking to them, and just at that moment, as they did, Madame Czerny's waters broke. So Edith had to arrange for a taxi to take her off to hospital and get to see a doctor. And Edith was told, "Well, you've got to go with her." And there they were with just their last 2 days to look for a place to live. And this was the second to the last day. And she goes rushing off to hospital with Madame Czerny because her need, she said, as she realized, is very much greater than theirs was at that point. Here was a matter of the tremendous need of a couple. And this turned out to be very important in their lives, in fact. Edith went down to the hospital with Madame Czerny. The baby was born that night, and Edith stayed in the hospital with her overnight and had a completely sleepless night. Francis had gone back to the village, back to Champéry, to be with the family, to look after the family for their last day, the last day of house hunting before them. In fact, the baby died 2 weeks later, and Edith recounts the very tragic story. The grandmother, who lived in Czechoslovakia, who'd been given a permit to leave Czechoslovakia to come and see her grandson, when she heard that the baby had died, the government revoked the permit and wouldn't let her leave, and she hung herself because she just wasn't prepared, she said, to carry on living in Czechoslovakia in the state it was at that time of tremendous repression in a situation with so little freedom. So this family was in tremendous need right then. And as those next few weeks went by, Edith could see very clearly how important it was that she had let go of her desperate search for a house and gone to help this woman in this situation at this time, to help this couple. So they were left then with just the final day for looking. In fact, Fran didn't go looking at all. He stayed back and started packing up their belongings, their books, from their house in Champéry, because he felt it was just hopeless. There wasn't any point in looking anymore. She felt she would just carry on looking once more, and she gives the whole story of this, both in the Le Bris story and in the tapestry, describing what happened. She went back up to the village of Villars, the town of Villars, and was looking around, and had it all figured out in her mind what she was going to do. when desperately looking around, was pushed out of somebody's house, who had a house for rent that was far more than she could possibly imagine, and she just possibly handle, and she just broke down in tears and tried to explain her situation. She'd had a night without sleep, so she was really near the end of her tether, just feeling absolutely desperate. And then she said, as she was walking down the street, not even looking up because she'd been weeping so much and her eyes were so swollen and red, she heard a voice calling out, Madame Schaefer, Madame Schaefer. And it was her real estate agent, Monsieur Gabu, G-A-B-U-Z, saying, have you found anything? Have you found anything? In French, of course. And she replied, no, we haven't. This was the man who had only the deluxe house. He said, well, I've got a house now for you to look at. And he took her down the valley to the village of Waymo. One thing that's important to notice is that they knew nothing about this village. She couldn't see the view. It was completely foggy when she got there to look at the house. He showed her around, and she liked the house and thought, at least there is something for us. And then just as he was driving off, she says, how much is the rent? And he said, it's not for rent, it's for sale. And she thought, oh no, that's impossible. And it was late afternoon by that time. She got on the bus and went down the valley and changed buses and went up the bus across the other side to Champéry. She was too frightened even to tell her husband that this house was for sale and not for rent. He was a pretty fierce guy in some ways. She was too frightened to tell him that. She thought, well, the Lord has shown it to me. So, and as she went to bed that night, she prayed, and oh Lord, if you want us to have this house, to buy this house, please send $1,000 by tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock, which was when they were going to when she was going to take him back to look at this place with the family. An amazing kind of prayer to pray, but obviously one that the Lord had put on their hearts, on her heart. So off they went the next morning to look at the house. They met the postman coming up from the village post office on his skis. You remember there had been an avalanche in Champéry and the roads were mostly out at that time, so the post was being delivered on skis. And as they went down to catch the train, they opened the letters, and they had a letter from a couple called the Salisburys. And let me just read a little bit about what the Salisburys said in their letter. This is Helen Salisbury writing, she and her husband Art. She says, I have a story to tell you that will interest you, Helen started her letter. Art came home from work 3 months ago with a check that was a surprise. The company paid all the insurance premiums for men who had worked a certain length of time and made it retroactive. We went to look at houses to invest in, and as we looked at the beams in a likely small house, I said, Art, look at those termites. Doesn't that remind you of the verse in Matthew which says not to lay up treasures on earth where moths and rust corrupt? Art said, yes, it did. And I said, would you be willing to take that literally and invest this money in heaven by giving it to the Lord's work somewhere? He replied, yes, Helen, I would. She went on to tell of their praying for clear certainty as to where to use this money for a period of 3 months. Now tonight, she said, and this is in her letter, we are convinced we should send the enclosed to you to buy a house that will always be open to young people. The amount of the check was exactly $1,000. And what was amazing as well was that when they came to this conclusion, it was when they were all ready to go to bed, and they became so convinced they ought to send the money off right away that they got dressed and they went out at night and they posted this letter, and it arrived in time for the answer to Edith's prayer. So God provided a house for them, and of course when they saw it that morning up at Waymo, it was still shrouded in fog. They still had no idea where, how beautiful the situation was in which they were finding a house. No idea at all, because when it's foggy in Switzerland, it can be completely foggy. That valley will fill up with fog solidly, and you can't see anything because you're basically right in the clouds. So a house was provided, the money was provided in answer to her prayer. And of course when she opened this letter and read it out to Francis and saw the money was in it, she told him that in fact the house was for sale, not for rent at all, and that's what she had prayed the night before, that this money would arrive by the next morning. So they became convinced that that's what they ought to do, that they ought to buy this house, and they said they would right away to the real estate agent. The next answer to their prayer, to their prayers, was that when they came in to fill in the application for the permit to stay and to have the annulment overturned, the official who was to do it for them in the canton of Vaud, which is a Protestant canton on this side of the valley where Huemo is, turned out to be an extremely good friend of Monsieur X, the man who had been converted through them in Champéry, and who was the reason why they were being thrown out, because of his conversion. So they had somebody who was on their side, who was put in that place by the Lord. And of course Mr. X went to him and poured out his story, and this man was happy to fill out as positive an application for them as he possibly could. Then the time came for them to move out. This had all just been sorted out in time. Edith recounts their packing and actually just getting across the river Rhone by midnight, which was when they had to leave the canton of Valais. And she says it gave them a tremendous sense of what it's like to be a refugee, but they had to be out of there. And of course over the next 2 years, many, many people who were refugees came to Le Brie from many, many different parts of the world. They had tremendous problems getting out because of the avalanches. The moving van couldn't come, and a guy turned up with a jeep to help them get across the fields. Swiss law is very, very strict. Very, very strict. That would have been that, no matter what they had found. If they hadn't been out of there in time, you know, the police made it very clear to them they had to go. Swiss law really is strict. Everything in Switzerland is absolutely precise. If you go to catch a train anywhere, the train arrives early so that it can depart to the second on time. I'm absolutely to the second. That's true everywhere in Switzerland. Everything is like that. Let me tell you a little story if you want to know how committed the Swiss are to having people keep their laws. A friend of mine was telling me this. He had some friends who were living in Geneva, American friends, and they hung their washing out one Sunday, and they got a notice from the city council the next week saying you will not hang your washing out on Sundays. It's against the law in Switzerland. This is ridiculous, you know, being Americans, very committed to total independence and freedom to do whatever you want to do. And they hung it out the next Sunday. And they got another letter and said, if you continue to hang your washing out, you will be asked to leave the country. The Swiss are very, very legalistic, one might say. They really do everything just exactly so. They had to leave the canton by the 31st. In fact, they had to leave Switzerland by the 31st. The only way to for that not to happen was if they could find somewhere to live in another canton by that time and get permission from the village in that other canton to live there. The village would have to apply to the commune of Orléans for them to live there, and the canton would have to agree that they would live there. But that all had to be set in motion before the 31st, otherwise they'd have to be out of the country. In other words, in order to fill in the appeal, which had to be sent off by a certain time, they had to have all this set in motion before the 31st, so they actually had somewhere to go. Otherwise they had to be out of the country by midnight that night. It was the federal government that had said they had to leave, though it had obviously come from the canton of Valais from the commune in which they lived, because of the local bishop, in fact. That was how they discovered what had happened. In order to even be able to appeal, to have any possibility of having banning order, if you like, their expulsion order overturned, they had to have somewhere else to live in another canton, which was happy to have them. And even then it wasn't certain, even if they did, that the federal government would overturn the banning order on them. But they had to be out of that canton by that time, and if they hadn't had somewhere else to live, they'd have had to be out of the country by March the 31st, midnight. They were so sure that God wanted them to do this work there, that that was what he was calling them to do, and that this money arriving was an answer to their prayers. Obviously it wasn't enough for the down payment. $1,000 isn't enough for a down payment on a house in Switzerland. But it was a sign to them that God really wanted them to be there. And over the next few weeks, they had to pray for the whole of the down payment to come. And they did do so, and it arrived in time. But even at the point when they put the down payment down, they didn't know yet whether in fact that the federal government would set aside their expulsion order. But in order to stay in Switzerland at all, they had to have another canton happy to have them, another commune happy to have them, and another village saying to the commune, we want to have you. And it has. All those things had to be in place. They had to have the village applying to the commune saying, we would like to have these people live here. The commune had to agree with that and apply to the canton to have them there. And all those forms had to be filled in and be worked through by the time they were to be thrown out of the country. That's why they had these terrible deadlines. We've got to find a house. If we don't find a house by that time, we can't get all this paperwork done, which has to be done before March the 31st. So they had to be across that river before March the 31st, but they also had to have the permission to live there. All dependent, of course, on the federal government's agreeing that the order expelling them from the country would be set aside, and they had to wait several months to find out whether that would happen. William Farrell, the reformer, he was the man who was so instrumental in encouraging Calvin to stay in Geneva. You know, when Calvin said wild horses wouldn't drag me to Geneva again after he'd been pushed out the first time, Farrell was the one who convinced him that he ought to stay in Geneva and work on bringing the Reformation into real place there. Farrell was not an organizer and administrator in the way that Calvin was. He was a preacher. And he was the one, in fact, who went around all these villages in the canton of Vaud preaching the gospel. He had an itinerant ministry. The Reformation wasn't just people like Calvin who were preaching in big cities like Geneva and sort of establishing a work there, starting a theological college and all of the other things that Calvin did, basically training pastors to go out all over the place. It also had people who were traveling all around these little villages preaching the gospel, and that was what William Farrell did. That's why the Schaeffers called their study room Farrell House, because Farrell had preached in those villages right there, in the village of Weimar and the other villages in that area. So they moved in just after midnight on March the 31st, 1955. In a way, one could say Labrie had begun. The work of Labrie had begun at that point. In fact, at breakfast the next morning, which Edith calls their first Labrie meal, at breakfast the next morning, there were quite a few people with them who were there right from the very beginning. There were three or four people who were there for breakfast, some who'd helped them move, some who'd been staying with them over in Champéry. I mean, of course, it was all chaotic. There was a little bit of furniture that came with the house. They had bits and pieces of their own furniture, which they brought over from Chalet Bijou. But they moved in after midnight, and the next morning, as they sat down for breakfast, they saw the beauty of the place that God had given to them for the first time. The clouds had come, and it really is incredibly beautiful. It's one of the most beautiful places I have ever seen. The view from there is just unbelievably beautiful. I wish I could show you some slides, actually. Perhaps we could get some. It might be a good thing to do if I can get some together. But it is unbelievably beautiful. The village of Weimar hangs right on the mountainside. Obviously, I haven't got the angles exactly right. It's several thousand feet up there on the side of the valley. It's way above the level at which they're growing grapes. The lower sides of the valley, just below the village of Olon and slightly above the village of Olon, have vineyards all up the side of the mountains on terraced fields, very, very steep terraced fields with little stone walls, but tiny little fields all up the sides there on the south-facing slopes of the mountain. The road is incredibly steep going up there with a whole series of hairpin bends up the side of that valley. Weimar is a very tiny little village, but the view is just unbelievably beautiful. I haven't been able to show the mountains on the other side, but it looks across to the mountain right opposite, which is called the Dent du Midi, which means the teeth of midday. It stands up like a series of jagged teeth against the sky, and you can actually see way back into the Alps. You can see all the way across into France, in fact, to Mont Blanc in the distance, when the view is very clear, which of course is always covered with snow all the year round. It's a very, very high mountain, one of the highest mountains in Western Europe. But there's this wonderful ranges of mountains just right across the whole of your vision there, just right in front of you. and on the opposite slopes of the valley, pine forests everywhere as well. It really is incredibly beautiful, just unbelievably beautiful. So really the work of Le Brie had begun. They had their first breakfast there. It's amazing the way God brings people from the very beginning. When the English Le Brie started in 1971, it was exactly the same way. The very first day they moved into this old manor house there, just before we arrived, a whole pile of people came, some with them and some just turned up. They had, there in England, we had a guy who was into Zen Buddhism turn up on the first day. You know, they had just arrived, and there was this guy at the window poking his head in with a bald, shaved head, you know, saying, you know, what's happening here? And he became a Christian over the next few weeks. But that's how their work started, with some people to take care of from the very beginning. They moved in actually on a Saturday. That was Saturday, April the 1st. They had their first church service there in the living room of Chalet Les Malaises the next day. The name of their chalet, I should put that up here for you, Les Malaises, which is a kind of pine tree. So there's some beautiful pines in the garden. That was the name of their chalet, though the work began to be called Le Brie right away from that time. Their home was called Le Brie, but they had their first church service in the living room there the next day. About 9 or 10 people assembled, including Mr. X, who came over from Champéry for the service there. And Edith describes the sermon that he preached that day. Actually has some quotes from it. His title was Put Your Feet in Jordan, which was a very appropriate sermon for the subject, for their situation. They were starting something completely new. They didn't know yet whether they'd definitely be able to stay, but they were determined that they were going to put their feet in Jordan. They were going to start doing the work, believing that God would, that God had called them to this, that they had to live by faith. And his scripture, his starting scripture, was Habakkuk 2 verse 4. Behold, this passage, the just shall live by faith. And he contrasted people who live out of their own strength and in their own pride, and those who live by faith, the power of God and the work of God. And that was a challenge to them at the beginning of the work. The real birth of Le Brie, Edith describes a few pages later in the book, page 428 and 429, was when people who, not just these people who moved over with them, but new people started coming. Their daughter Priscilla started at university down in Lausanne. Again, I ought to write these places up for you because otherwise you won't know them. This is back along the valley this way, is the town of Lausanne, which is on near Lake Geneva. And there's a university down there. It's where Priscilla went to university. And she asked whether she could bring a girl home, a girl called Grace, home for the weekend. This is just a month later, May the 6th to the 9th. And Edith wanted to say no, she says. There were so many problems. The hot water boiler had broken. The furnace didn't work. The wood stove smoked. She had to do her washing in the bathtub because their washing machine didn't work yet. It had a different voltage. The refrigerator wasn't working, and nor was the iron. Nothing was unpacked still. They were living in just absolute chaos. And Priscilla described this girl. Grace is tall and looks like she stepped off the cover of a Vogue magazine. And Edith thought, well, I can't possibly have somebody like that. Well, we are living in such total chaos. But she said she swallowed her pride and said, yes, you can bring her along. But she came, and then several other people came, including Dorothy Jameson, who's now Dorothy Woodson, whose husband is an elder here down at Old Orchard Church, and various other people as well, stopped by for that weekend. And that's really when the work began. In fact, by the time the weekend came, they had no electricity at all because there was a storm which knocked the electricity out, so they just had candlelight. But they had their first real Le Brie weekend at that point. And the weekend was filled with all the things that came what Le Brie was in all the years to come, with meals that Edith cooked and tried to serve in a pleasant atmosphere despite the lack of electricity. And lots of discussions, long discussions, a Sunday service, and more discussions over lunch after the service, walks, when the weather was good, and it was that weekend, walks in the beautiful, really, really beautiful landscape all around there. In the summer, you can't walk through any of the fields after about April the 1st, but there are footpaths everywhere you can walk on. You can't walk through any fields at all because all the stuff growing there is used for pasture. It has to be mowed. The people who live there are totally dependent upon that as part of their livelihood. But between April the 1st and I guess it's about October the 1st, you can't walk actually on the fields. You walk, but there are footpaths all over the mountains, everywhere there, as well as the little roads. But they would be going for walks and having discussions. And that was really how their work began. That was where, at that weekend, Edith's institution of high tea on Sundays began. So there wouldn't have to be another cooked meal. And she'd make thousands and thousands of little sandwiches of all different kinds and try to serve it all very nicely. But that was the work beginning. They still had to pray for the money for the down payment on the house. And they decided again that they wouldn't write and let people know how much money they needed or ask anybody for money, but they would pray that God would provide for them, that he would demonstrate that he wanted them there. And she writes about it this. She says, over these next weeks, gifts in varying amounts arrived from 156 scattered people, totaling exactly enough for Fran and Pris to take to Egel to pay at the notaire's office. She said, only 8 days before that date, the final date, we only had just under $5,000. Yet when the last mail on the morning of May the 30th arrived, we were bought 15 letters from the village post office with gifts which added up to make $7,366. And so they had enough to make their whole down payment just in time. Their permit finally arrived on June the 21st to say that they could in fact stay there from the government with their the insistence that they leave Switzerland marked all over with the words annulled. So now they were firmly set to live in that situation.